Welcome to Five Books for Catholics, where an expert selects and explains five outstanding books in some aspect of Catholic life, doctrine, or culture. Mary Flannery O'Connor lived from 1925 to 1964. Today we remember her as simply Flannery O'Connor. She was a novelist and writer of short stories whose Southern Gothic fiction is informed by her deep Catholic faith. Born and raised in Georgia, after graduating from college, she earned a master's degree at the University of Iowa's prestigious Iowa Writers Workshop, after which she embarked upon a career as a writer. In 1941, her father had died from lupus, and in 1952, she was diagnosed with the same disease. Undeterred by her illness, she attended Mass every day, supported local Catholic newspapers with numerous book reviews, and wrote most of her fiction. She is remembered above all for her short stories, which won the U.S. National Book Award for Fiction in 1972. In this interview, Father Damien Ferrance will discuss O'Connor's work. Father Damien Ferrance is a priest of the Diocese of Cleveland, where he serves as Vicar for Evangelization, Secretary for Parish Life and Special Ministries, and as Professor of Philosophy at Borromeo Seminary. He holds a licentiate in philosophy from the Catholic University of America and a doctorate in philosophy from the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas in Rome. He writes regularly on the intersection of faith and culture for a variety of outlets and is the author of the award-winning book, The Strangeness of Truth. He's also the author of Understanding the Hillbilly Thomas, the philosophical foundation of Flannery O'Connor's narrative art, published by Word and Fire in 2023. Father Ferrance is the founder and director of Tolle Legge Summer Institute and is a lifetime member of the Flannery O'Connor Society. Father Damien, welcome.
Thank you, Father Dominic. It's a joy to be with you today.
First of all, what's missing from the preceding interview of Flannery O'Connor's life?
Quite a bit. The fact that she was also known, and I cover this in the book, that she was also a cross trainer as an artist. So not only did she write narrative fiction, which, as you mentioned, she's best known for her short stories, she's also known for her two novels. She's also known for writing letters and essays. But she was also, and a lot of people don't know this, she was also a painter. And she liked to paint because she said, painting helps you see. And a big part of being an artist, according to Flannery O'Connor, is one's ability to see what actually is. So although she wrote every morning from 9 to 12 after going to Mass, and then she would spend her afternoons sometimes visiting people, sometimes writing letters, sometimes having appointments, but she also spent time as a painter and as an artist, painting what she saw, and a lot of it was landscapes. So I think that's an interesting part of her biography that a lot of people don't know, but I cover part of that in the book, that the importance of the artist to see what actually is, because the artist's job is then to make what she sees or what he sees present to those who are reading her work or viewing her paintings.
And if I recall correctly, she wasn't just a painter. As when she was at college, she also drew a lot of cartoons, which would explain the humorous vein in her fiction.
Correct. Yeah, that goes. So there's actually two collections of her cartoons. She was the editor of her college newspaper, and she was even doing cartoons even earlier on. And she would send her cartoons to the New Yorker magazine, and she would save her rejection slips, which I think is pretty great too. I saved all my rejection slips because O'Connor saved hers. And if you're going to be a writer, you're going to know that some people won't want what you're doing sometimes, and that's okay. You keep moving, you keep doing your craft, and eventually someone will pick up your work. So I think that's great.
And how did Flannery O'Connor conceive the relation between her faith and her fiction?
Well, her faith informed her fiction in that she believed that the world was created by God and that the world was also fallen because of original sin and redeemed because of the salvific act of Jesus. And she says over and over again in her letters that she writes the way that she does because she is a Catholic, and that she it's in her blood, it's in her bones, and that is how she sees the world. That is her incarnational vision of things. So when it comes to her art, that is going to come out. And a lot of times people, when they first read her work, don't understand that at all. And that's why the book is entitled Understanding the Hillbilly Thomist, because it comes from a line early in her letters where she was going to go on TV, and she had received some early reviews of her first novel, and some people had accused her of being a nihilist, because her work can often be dark, it can be violent, and it can be grotesque. So folks can, on first read, say, I don't know what I just read there. The grandmother got shot along with her whole family. Someone just got her leg stolen. A woman got gored by a bull. I don't understand how this could be a Catholic writer doing any of this. But what she often does is she'll use violence, not for the sake of violence, but to wake her reader up. She says, to the hard of hearing, you need to shout. To the almost blind, you need to draw large, startling figures. So in the same way that a crucifix could be shocking at first, especially if you haven't seen one before, you're like, why in the world would you hang a image of someone being crucified in the walls of your church or on the walls of your home? If you actually understand that the crucifix is our incarnate Lord who poured himself out for the sake of the salvation of the world, then you see that violence actually also is a great act of love that Jesus has taken on himself. So in the same way, when it comes to understanding O'Connor's fiction, I argue in the book that if you try to remove her Catholicism and specifically her Thomism from your interpretation, you're going to be missing most of what she's trying to do. I'm not saying that it's the only way to interpret her, but I'm saying if you try to interpret her apart from that, I think you're going to come up short.
But when we say she's a Catholic writer, she doesn't try to present the faith directly, if I understand correctly. Often it's insinuated or it's in the background.
Yes, that's true. So she, in her collection of essays, which is called Mystery and Manners, she has a few essays in there in which she says that if you're going to be an artist, you first need to be an artist. So you ought not try, hey, I'm a Catholic and I want to evangelize people and I think I could write a cool story about that. Well, if you don't have the gift and the talent of being a short story writer, then leave that up to the short story writers, because you'll actually do more harm than good. So if you're going to be an artist, the most important thing is to be a good artist. And she's an artist who is also Catholic, so her Catholicism is going to come out in her art. But you're right, it's not direct. She's not writing stories. Most of her stories are not about Catholics at all. Most of them are about backwood Protestants. She has a couple references to some priests or some nuns in her stories, but most of what she's doing is she's telling good stories. She's creating good art. And because her art is good and because she's a Catholic, her metaphysics, what underlies all of what she's doing is there to be found. But you're right, it's not simplistic. It's not it's not vapid Catholicism, and it's not stories about pious little children, she would say. She actually, at one of the beginnings of one of her essays, the one Memoir to Marianne, she says, stories of pious children tend to be false. And then she writes this whole foreword to a book that the Hawthorne Dominican sisters had written about a girl who had cancer, who lived for 12 years, and O'Connor wrote the introduction to that. So there's a reason that a lot of non-Catholics, atheists, agnostics, people who have no religious affiliation, but who love good art and good fiction, love Flannery O'Connor's work, because it stands on its own as excellent fiction, as excellent narrative art. And people are often surprised when they realize, my gosh, this woman's a Catholic. She was a daily mass goer. And conversions have happened because of that, because they encountered good, beautiful art and were struck by it and thought, I want to know more about this author, and then started reading about her life and said, if that's what Catholicism is, I can get on board with that.
And why should Catholics read Flannery O'Connor?
Well, there's a lot to read, and people often say, well, where do I start? So I think Catholics should read Flannery O'Connor because she's a great narrative artist, and Catholics should be interested in anything that is true, good, and beautiful. And sometimes what O'Connor does is she will show the true by showing what's not true. She will show the beautiful by showing what is grotesque. And so one of the ways that she gets about her art is to show what's not and leaves like a vacuum or a void, and you desire what actually is. So I think there's a lot of reasons to read Flannery O'Connor. One is because her art is so good. Secondly, the way that she is able to show what is not is also to display or to manifest at least the longing for what is or what ought to be. So in much of her fiction, we'll find disfigurements, whether it's in the human person or a missing part of a body or a shriveled up part of a body in Mr. Shiflet's arm. And those symbols take on great meaning within her fiction because they are displaying what is and what also ought to be. And so I think, like, when I was a parish priest, I used to do a summer book club, and I would always pick two Flannery O'Connor stories to cover during that summer book club, which lasted for about, we usually would read three books, and I'd work in two O'Connor stories. And I found that whether it was the teenager, the young adult, the middle ager, the empty nester, or even the seniors, at first they're like, I'm not sure about this. But once they understood more of what she was doing and what she was trying to accomplish in her fiction, there was a great appreciation for her work and a different way of seeing the world and engaging the world that maybe they hadn't considered before. And I think O'Connor was brilliant. She was an artistic genius. And anytime a Catholic can be reading the work of an artistic genius, it's helpful to expanding one's soul.
You mentioned your book club that you ran when you were parish priest. The Tolly Leggi Summer Institute a continuation and an expansion of that project?
You know, it was inspired by it. So I was ordained in 2003. And I had a lot of missions or assignments at my first parish, things that the pastor wanted me to do. And one of the things that I asked if I could do during the summers, because since summer months were a little slower, was could I do a summer book club? Because I used to read a lot in the summers. My mom used to read a lot. And I thought this would be a nice thing to do. So I did that in the summers. And I found that a lot of young people, teenagers even, were interested in reading and studying the faith. And I also ran RCIA at my first parish, so I was bringing teenagers into the church every year, and we had a very large youth group at my parish. And what I found was that there were some teens who were far advanced in their faith, and if I catered the youth group to them, I'd lose all the other kids, but they needed special care. So in the States, we have what we call advanced placement courses, like AP History, AP English, AP French, or whatever it is. And so when I started my work at the seminary, in conversation with a few of my colleagues, one of the things that we discovered was there were camps for like spirituality for young people. There were camps for band. There were camps for sports. But there were no camps for supported the intellectual tradition of the Catholic Church. And we had a seminary, and our seminarians were home in the summer, so we also had a faculty, we had empty rooms, and we have 185 parishes in the diocese. I knew a lot of the youth ministers, and so we started a camp called Tolly Leggi or Tolly Leggi, and invited young men and women heading into their senior year to join us to study philosophy, theology, liturgy, and Catholic culture. And we've been doing this now for 13 years. In the first 7 years of doing this, 18 of the guys who did it joined our seminary. Not all of them stayed, but it was a great way to bring people up to see what we do at the seminary. And even the girls who spent time there, a lot of them wound up being theology majors or studying philosophy, or even if they went into other areas of study, they had a deep experience of what Catholicism looked like as a young adult, and had learned a love of reading and a love of liturgy of the hours, and understood that the church was smart and was interested in art and beauty. So, yeah, our Tolle Lege program, it was inspired by a lot of what I did in my first 4 years as a parish priest. That's true.
And the title, for those that don't know Latin, comes from the Confessions, Tolle Lege,
yes.
Take up and read. It's the voice, it's the words St. Augustine hears that prompts him to pick up the New Testament, read St. Paul.
Right. So it's at the end of book 8, and St. Augustine has been struggling, and lust had been a major sin that he had been dealing with much of his life. And he's at a point, he's in this garden, his buddy Alypius is there, he's not too far from his mom, Monica, and he's saying, geez, I've been struggling. When are you going to do this, Lord? When are you going to set me free? And all of a sudden, he hears a voice that sounds like children saying, Tolle Lege, or Tolle Lege. Now, here's the interesting thing. When I was at Catholic U, I had a Latin tutor, and I asked her, I said, would Augustine have said, heard Tolle Lege or Lege? And she said, because he was trained in classical Latin, it probably would have been a hard G, although many people say Tolle Lege. But anyway, so he hears this voice, and he remembers that St. Anthony of the Desert basically played Bible roulette, like opened up the scriptures and was moved. So he said, maybe that's what I'm supposed to do. He opens up to Romans and he reads from St. Paul. And at that moment, he feels healed, he feels free, and his life is changed. So that's his Tolle Lege or Tolle Lege moment. And so because much of our Summer Institute is taking up and reading the tradition, we named the Institute after that. So St. Augustine is the patron saint. The unofficial patron is Flannery O'Connor, since she's not canonized, but she is a great Catholic that we want to introduce our young people to, especially the way that she was able to engage the world. I mean, keep in mind, this is a woman who was studying at, whether it was at Iowa or she was at Yaddo or whether she was in New York City, most of her circle of colleagues were not the faithful Catholics that she was. The Fitzgeralds were, for sure, and a few other friends, but a lot of the folks that she hung around as fellow artists did not share her faith. So she thought that I have to know this faith well, and I have to be able to answer for it, and I'm going to answer for it mostly in my art. I'm just going to let my art speak for what is true and what is real. And so she wasn't, as you know, Paul VI would say, or John Paul II, she wasn't imposing, but she was proposing truth in her fiction. That was a big part of her mission.
And what drew you to study and write on Flannery O'Connor?
Well, when I was a senior in seminary, and we partner with John Carroll University, which is the Jesuit university here in Cleveland, I took a poetry workshop class with a guy named George Bilguer, pretty well-published poet. And we were writing two poems a week for this workshop class. And he would pick a poem each week, and he would have one of the students read it, and then we would workshop it. And he picked one of my poems and said, well, Damien's poem reminds me of Flannery O'Connor. And I thought, well, that's a compliment. So I took out my pen and I wrote down Flannery O'Connor. And I thought, I got to figure out who this guy is later on tonight, you know? Lo and behold, I figure out Flannery O'Connor was not a he, but was a she. And that was actually intentional, because her baptismal name is Mary Flannery O'Connor. And she went by Mary Flannery O'Connor until she went to graduate school. And she thought, you know what, to get along and to get through some of these editors who may be sexist, I'm going to drop the Mary and just go by Flannery O'Connor. So that was her artistic decision when she was in grad school. So I read her work, started reading her work my senior year in college, spent the summer reading most of her fiction. And I started getting into her essays. But what really hooked me was when I was reading her letters. So she has a book called The Habit of Being, which is a collection of her letters. And I was reading that book as I was a seminary intern in theology, in my theologate studies. And my mom, at the time when I was reading that book, was in her last days. Well, actually, it was her last year. My mom had cancer, and this was her last bout with it. It was liver cancer. And she wound up living for 53 weeks with this cancer at a cancer home run by Hawthorne Dominican Sisters. Now, that's important because when I told Sister Kevin, my mom's nurse, that I'm reading a book that keeps mentioning her order, she says, "Who you reading, Flannery?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, and I said, "How did you know?" She said, "I knew her because my mom's nurse nun, a Dominican sister, when she was young, worked at the cancer home in Atlanta, Georgia, and used to visit Flannery O'Connor on her farm. Flannery was friends with those Dominicans. In fact, when Flannery died, she willed her peacocks to go to those Dominican sisters." So all these things were lining up. My poetry class, reading her, my mom's nurse nun was a friend of Flannery. When I was ordained, the sisters gave me some pictures of Flannery O'Connor as a gift, and she just kept following me through my life. And so when I wound up at getting sent for doctoral studies, I chose the Angelicum because I felt that was where I should go. And I thought, if I could write on anything I really love, it would be Flannery O'Connor. And when I get there, who else is there but a Dominican named Father Thomas Joseph White? Where's he originally from? Georgia. He's a convert. He converted partially by reading Flannery O'Connor. He's also East Coast Province Dominican, and he's in a band called the Hillbilly Thomists. So when all those stars lined up, that is not coincidence. That just is not happenstance. That I read that as God's providence calling me to this. And I felt, I mean, I've been down to Georgia quite a few times on pilgrimage, and I felt in some ways that Flannery was inviting me, a priest, to do some of this work. So that sounds weird, perhaps, but I think that was part of my vocation, within my vocation as a priest, to spend a few years doing some hardcore study and turning a dissertation eventually into a book.
And before we go on to discuss the books by Flannery O'Connor that you've selected, do you have any thoughts on Ethan Hawke's upcoming film on Flannery O'Connor?
You know, well, I definitely want to see it. And a week ago today, I watched Bishop Barron's interview with Ethan Hawke and Maya Hawke on Word on Fire. And so I am interested to see it. I know that some of the controversy now is over a sex scene. And that's interesting because in O'Connor's stories, there are no sex scenes. So it must be like an imagination or filling out of something that was insinuated. So I don't know how that's going to be. So I'll see it first, and then I'll make a recommendation or not make a recommendation. But I only watched Bishop Barron's interview, and that particular controversy never came up in the interview. But I'm hoping that perhaps Ethan and Maya Hawke may get a hold of my book and be able to read it before they go in their final editing phase, because I think it could be helpful.
And first up is Flannery O'Connor's most acclaimed work, her complete short stories. Do any central themes run through them?
The drama of human living, which almost always includes suffering, darkness, and some violence, is part of what O'Connor's trying to show. So she's trying to show the human condition, the fallenness of the world, and always at least an opportunity for grace breaking into that brokenness, that fallenness, that darkness. Sometimes that grace is accepted, other times it's rejected. But the grace is always offered. So I would say that is a theme that you can find in each and every one of her stories. If you could look for that moment of grace, you could say, okay, I've got that. Now let's take a look at how that wound up being the case, and then what was the character's response to the grace. So I do think grace breaking through is a major theme in all of O'Connor's stories. And it develops as she develops.
And which sort of stories, no spoilers, would you recommend in particular?
Okay, so I will give you the three stories that I cover in my book. So in my metaphysics chapter, I give you an overview of how Flannery O'Connor understands reality, how she understands the world, how she understands God. And the story that I use to show all of that work that I did on the front end of the chapter is a short story called The River. And The River is a story about a young man named Harry Ashfield, who takes the name Bevel. He's about 4 or 5 years old, and his parents aren't taking the best care of him, so he goes out with a babysitter one day, and some spectacular things happen in his life that make him think about reality and what he's known thus far and what he ought to know. And I'll just let your viewers read that for themselves. But I think The River is an excellent short story, and I think I offer some original contributions to the analysis of it. So I would say that would be one. In the epistemology chapter, and for your folks who don't know what epistemology is, it's our way of knowing things. Well, what can one know? How does Flannery O'Connor think we come to know God and the world and even ourselves? And what is there to know? What kind of truths are to know? And so at the end of that chapter, I do a nice analysis of a short story called Parker's Back. And there's a man named Parker who, as a kid, goes to a carnival. He sees a guy all tatted up, bunch of tattoos. So as an adult, even as a young adult, he starts to get a bunch of tattoos all over his body, except he doesn't get one on his back. And one day he feels like, I got to get a tattoo on my back. And I'll let your viewers read for themselves. But Parker eventually makes a decision to find a proper tattoo for his back, and then the rest of the story unfolds. So I think that's a great one. And especially if one is teaching college students, I think that's a great way to start, because O'Connor, I think, foresaw the tattoo craze before it became a craze. And I think it's a nice story. And then finally, her longest short story is called The Displaced Person. And in my final chapter, I cover Flannery O'Connor's ethics. And I think The Displaced Person, well, there's many ways to approach it. But the way that it's a story about a woman who owns a farm. She has some helpers on her farm, but then come an immigrant family from Poland. And then Mr. Gwizdak is a very hard worker, and his family is disrupting the order that's already on the farm. So there's many ways to approach this story, but I like to approach the story in terms of community, in terms of relations, in terms of what is the right thing to do, and how God becomes either a focal point or something to be denied in terms of building that community and living properly. So it's a story that's also gaining a lot of traction, especially during this post-COVID time when inclusion and diversity and immigration, all these things are being talked about. She, again, kind of foresaw a lot of these conversations, and she contributes to them there. Not to mention that the writing's just fantastic.
Is it accurate to characterize Flannery O'Connor's fiction as Southern Gothic?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think you can't understand O'Connor well without understanding her Catholicism, but it's also true that you can't understand her well without understanding the fact that she's a Southerner, and that the region matters, and that you have to be writing from a particular place. So Catholics are big on specificities. So she doesn't want to write, she'll write about universal themes, but always in a particular and specific place. And I think that's very important to her. Region is very important to her. Place is very important to her. In fact, I want to say it was in 2014, there was an international Flannery O'Connor conference in Ireland at All Hallows College, and I think the title of it was On Place, Flannery O'Connor and Place. So, about 9 years ago, the conference was in particular about that. So understanding her as a Southerner, particularly what it means to lose, you know, with the Civil War and the South had lost, and you understand that. She thought that was an important part of understanding where Southerners come from and how they approach reality in the world. So.
But readers who do not hail from the American South might not get Flannery O'Connor. They might find the setting of her stories bizarre, macabre, grotesque. As a result, some might find them off-putting, notwithstanding all their humor. Do you have any tips to help disconcerted readers overcome this impression and appreciate her stories?
Yes, absolutely. So read Mystery and Manners, and that is a collection of essays and prose that was published after she died. And she explains a lot of her stories and a lot of her approach in those essays. And many of the essays that are included in there, when she would go on the circuit and visit different universities, she would often give a lecture beforehand, and then she would read one of her stories. So you can hear from her own perspective on what she's trying to do in her stories. And I found that extremely helpful. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, so I'm a northerner, and I have made trips down to the South. I visited her farm and her childhood home and her home parish, and I visited her cemetery. And even that, going on pilgrimage, I found all that to be helpful too. I think it would be similar to something like this. Back in 2017, I went to the Holy Land for the first time. Reading the Gospels and praying with the Gospels is marvelous and it's wonderful. But there is something different when you go to the Holy Land and you actually see Jerusalem, or you see the Sea of Galilee, and you go to Peter's home in Capernaum. You see things, and then you start to understand them even more deeply. If one is able and is able to make a Flannery O'Connor pilgrimage and visit her childhood home in Savannah or visit her farm in Milledgeville, you will actually see things on that farm that you see in her story. So for instance, there's a great short story called Good Country People, and a barn with a second story plays a prominent role in that short story. When you are on her farm and you look on the back part of her property, you see the barn that she writes about in that short story. And you see her mother in a lot of these short stories. You see Flannery O'Connor herself in a lot of these short stories as the over-educated Southerner who used to be in New York and comes home. So I think the more you dive into her complete works, not just her stories and novels, but her letters and her essays, and even make pilgrimage, the better you understand her work.
Thank you for listening. To read or listen to the rest of this interview and gain full access to our archive, visit 5booksforcatholics.com and become a premium subscriber. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and give it a top rating on the platform of your choice. That way, more people can discover it. You can also support the podcast and help us produce more interviews like this one by making a one-off donation via the link given in the show notes. As little as $1, £1 or €1 can help and will be greatly appreciated. Thank you once again, and God bless.